Welcome to Grumpy Strategists, episode 41. I'm your host, Michael Shoebridge from Strategic Analysis Australia, and I'm partly here, with Dr. Marcus Hellyer, the head of research. Marcus, how are you up there?
I'm great. I'm up on the bridge of the world's biggest electric ship. So some of you may have heard that Incat, great little Australian company, has launched the world's biggest electric vessel.
China Zorilla,
amazing name. Who is China Zorilla? Michael, you were trying to tell me that they're a wrestler. They are not a wrestler. I can't believe anything you ever tell me.
Used to watch a famous Uruguayan wrestler called China Zorilla.
With one of those masks? Yeah. No, China Zorilla, very famous Uruguayan actor and director. So, amazing ship here, but very new. No one's ever done anything like it before, so they've asked us to come in and do the sea trials. It's dangerous work, but they've gone to the best of the best. Here we are. I'm up on the bridge steering it. Downstairs is a 2,300 square meter duty-free retail shopping deck.
It's the largest duty-free shopping deck on a ship in the Southern Hemisphere. And let me tell you, you think sea trials and all those navigation and propulsion systems are important to test. I'm telling you, the Dewar's duty-free purchasing process down here needs to be very rigorously tested, and I'm really putting it through its steps down here.
I'm glad, again, they've got the best of the best checking out the duty-free processes down there.
Just don't make any sudden moves. You know, we heard about an F/A-18 Super Hornet coming off the USS Truman, and they turned quickly to avoid the Hooties.
But don't worry.
If I'm spilling some of this premium scotch on
you, you will not be spilling any of your Dewars. But all jokes aside, congratulations to Incat. As we said, a great Australian company competing with the best in the world and winning. So there are no government subsidies involved in this. They are actually doing this all by themselves.
Well, it's the world's largest fully electric ship. It's got a massive battery. It's got about a 90-minute range, but it's poodling backwards and forwards over the Plate River between Uruguay and Argentina.
Yeah, it's carrying 2,100 passengers, 225 vehicles. This is not a small vessel.
And the whole thing is, it's cost competitive, not just to build and sell. Congratulations to Incat, but it's cost competitive to operate because of its electric system. So it is really incredible. Incat has been doing something Australians might have heard of called continuous shipbuilding now.
Continuous shipbuilding, huh?
Like, I remember them being one of the key reasons that the Australian defence deployment to East Timor was successful, because at short notice, defence leased an Incat fast catamaran, a transport vessel, and that meant that supplies could be got to the ADF in East Timor. Without that, the operation probably would have failed.
And then all of a sudden, after the operation, we decided aluminium vessel, not wary enough. How can you possibly have good ships made of aluminium? And we ended the lease. Fortunately, the Uruguayans have a different perspective and do see value in Incat's ships. So that's great news. You know, we keep banging on about it in our podcast, that there is great Australian industry out there.
It's not even just great industry, it's great innovative industry. Now, back in 1999, large fast catamaran for transport was a novelty. It's now a commonplace because of Incat and other companies' work.
And picked up not just by the commercial sector, but by the US military that have been using fast catamaran ferries.
And now bringing electric propulsion to be commercially viable. Mm-hmm. But there are some other great Australian companies doing fantastic work right now.
So EOS, so a local Canberra company, does a Slinger counter-drone system. I think it had some success exporting to Ukraine, but they've just announced another export success into a unnamed Western European navy. So they're now getting into the maritime space. So again, congratulations to them. And Gilmour Space, tell us about Gilmour Space.
Well, Gilmour Space, they're on the cusp of launching their 25-metre Eris rocket, which is capable of putting payloads into space, from a space launch facility up in North Queensland. They aborted the attempt because they had a problem with the nose cone, but they've already replaced that nose cone, so they will be ready to go again soon.
So there was a slight glitch, but these things happen.
Well, you know, the whole history of firing rockets into space is you learn from failure. So you never have just unalloyed success. But one of the features I love about the Gilmour Space story is they didn't originally plan to have a space launch facility. It was going to be provided to them by the Queensland government and other partners. That just bogged down.
You're not telling me that the private sector moved with greater agility and speed than the public sector, are you?
Well, yeah. So instead of waiting for someone else to provide the space launch facility, Gilmour just went on and built one themselves. So that's a remarkable achievement, let alone this incredible rocket that they're about to launch.
So hopefully the successful launch will happen in the next few weeks. And when it does, we can report back to our listeners. So lots of good news on the Australian industry front. But I guess internationally, big news in the last week or so has been Donald Trump's visit to the Middle East. And when I look at this, I just go, it's the disruptor in action. Wherever he goes, he brings disruption. Is it good disruption or bad disruption, though?
Well, this is a mixed bag, frankly. I mean, I think what he did in the Middle East is like the photo negative of what American governments have done in the Middle East until extremely recently. So wasn't it amazing that when an American president visited the Middle East, a country they didn't go to was a country called Israel, which has been America's premier ally in that part of the world for decades. And that nation is still at war with Hamas in Gaza at the moment. And not so long ago, Netanyahu and Donald Trump were the closest possible pals with the Gaza in a Riviera Gaza thing. And it's so last season. But also, Trump gave a speech, and there are a lot of people saying, I love bits of that speech. You know, this idea of not trying to change regime.
We're not going to lecture you on how you should behave.
Yep, stop being interventionist. I think they're not lecturing you on how to behave is a mixed bag, frankly, because a commitment to human rights as a universal thing seems to me to be something that should be baked in to democratic countries. And America has been the standard bearer of that, although the intervention
has been applied rather selectively over time, though.
But to completely throw it over as something that America's not interested in, that's an incredible inversion of American policy.
So, yes, I would agree there. Now, you know, I'm the first one to say that American interventions in the Middle East over the last several decades have not been uniformly successful. You know, and Donald Trump did say that America's nation building has probably destroyed more nations than it has created. And I think there is an element of truth to that. And I would say that the Beltway blob approach to the Middle East has not been particularly successful. Others may have a different view. So some disruption is probably a good thing. The trouble with Trump is, though, he never follows through with anything. He's a destroyer, not a builder. So he may disrupt the old regime, but it's not clear what the new one is that he has in mind, other than one that produces amazing deals.
I think you're right. And, you know, I think to characterize the American neocon movement, which is associated with George W. Bush and the invasion of Iraq and the way that all turned to absolute custard, with a commitment to international human rights, I think is an extraordinary misremembering of history. The neocons were not the standard bearers for universal human rights. So American interventionist policy, like in Iraq, was an abject failure. And Trump noticing that is good. But your point about, well, is there a replacement policy, I think is kind of spot on. My view is we really have in the Trump administration an attention deficit administration. So right now, the Middle East and this approach to reaching out to the sheikhs that rules the Saudi Arabia and Qatar and the UAE, that's all the rage. That's the big thing. That's the new news. But the caravan will have moved on in 1 or 2 weeks. And the attention deficit disorder administration will be absolutely focused on a new shiny toy. That's what's happened this whole time.
Well, we see that with Ukraine. So Trump fell in love with Putin and blamed Zelensky for the war. Then when Putin didn't immediately roll over and agree to Trump's peace proposal, he sort of fell out with Putin. Now he seems to have fallen back in love with Putin because he realizes that if they lift sanctions on Russia, guess what? There'll be lots of deals. So it is this swinging backwards and forwards on foreign relations. It's swinging backwards and forwards on tariffs. Everything swings backwards and forwards.
Well, there has been one thing that he's loved doing, that the Trump administration and Trump himself has loved doing, and that is announcing business deals. So part of the torturing of Zelensky in Ukraine was about signing a deal for American companies to get hold of Ukraine's mineral wealth. And he was very unhappy when Zelensky just didn't want to hand it all over. Then he managed to sign a deal, and that was a triumph for at least a day, mm-hmm. I think. But the Middle East trip has been all about Boeing aircraft deals, Qatari Airways, saying they're going to buy 210 of these planes.
Which they probably would have anyway, but...
Well, yes. I mean, the idea that it was all orchestrated by Donald Trump, and it's an act of genius. I think if the Qataris have managed to make Donald Trump believe that, that's a masterful thing that they've done. But the other deals that have been part of this Middle East trip has been opening American export of its most advanced artificial intelligence chips to these Middle Eastern autocratic regimes. So about 500,000... NVIDIA AI chips going to the UAE for a bigger data center to drive artificial intelligence than OpenAI is building.
So itself. Are you suggesting that empowering Middle Eastern autocrats with huge AI capabilities is potentially a bad thing?
I do. I think it's, if AI is a source of enormous power and influence in our world in the near future, giving that power to these Middle Eastern autocratic states is really a major error, an absolute major error. As someone I respect on all this AI stuff observed, winning the AI race with China is not about selling more AI chips than the other guy. It's about the use and application and governance of artificial intelligence with its implications, including the destruction of the human race. So I think handing that kind of potential power to these autocratic regimes, that's the opposite to not telling them how to live their lives. That's potentially giving them the power to
dictate to all of us how to live our lives. Well, I don't know. I think you just can't see a good deal when you see one. Plus, Donald Trump gets a plane out of it.
That would be one of the funniest and most damaging things. I mean, my view is Trump floats these crazy ideas, like the Qataris are going to give me a plane that I can fly around in because Boeing are taking too long to make new Air Force Ones, and it's got all the gold taps I could possibly imagine. He does it partly to obscure the enormous business deals that the Trump family is making.
And that's working.
And to distract from things like, what are the implications of this big AI chip deal?
It is exactly working.
And then also, at one level, if he can get away with it, he will. So it's sort of a distraction. But if it then looks viable, he'd be delighted to accept the Qatari plane. It's kind of how he rolls.
Yeah. And the latest sort of big Trump idea is Golden Dome. So there's been some announcements about Golden Domes. This better version of Israel's Iron Dome. I mean, gold is much better than iron. So this air and missile defense system that's going to protect the United States from every conceivable air and missile threat. Donald Trump seems to think it's going to be operational by 2029, and it's going to come at a fairly trivial cost of
$25 billion. The initial funding that he's putting into the Pentagon budget, I think it's been delivered
25 billion next year.
Yeah, 25 billion. I mean, there's a lot of humor here for something that is about an actual real vulnerability. Continental America is actually vulnerable to nuclear-armed intercontinental ballistic missiles, and there are likely to be space-launched weapons that can also target continental America, and of course, long-range drones. So it is vulnerable. That's true. But the idea that for $175 billion and in 3-4 years, you're going to have a comprehensive homeland defense system that shoots down intercontinental ballistic missiles with multiple independently targeted warheads on each one.
Right across the United States.
Across the whole
plus
country.
Every other airborne threat.
And it's modeled on Israel because, I don't know, Iron Dome is a kind of point defense system for short-range, fairly agricultural rockets and missiles like those fired at Israel by Hezbollah and Hamas and Iran. It's an extremely capable system. stop. But how big is Israel compared to America?
It's close, isn't it? Already, it's the same size as New Jersey.
New Jersey, one of the smaller American
states. So actually not very close at all.
Yeah, so, but on some of the humor, when I hear Golden Dome, I think of Austin Powers or James Bond, but more Austin Powers, frankly.
Well, James Bond is a parody, and Austin Powers is a parody.
And I think of Dr. Evil. So it's hard to get a sense of reality about this announcement.
Well, and what's interesting about the year 2029 in Donald Trump land? Well, that's the end of his presidency. So essentially he's saying, I will have achieved this by the end of my presidency.
Yes. He may not have a new Air Force One by that time, but there will be a comprehensive continental US missile, drone and space launched weapons defense system that is comprehensive. And I think in his announcement, it said it will end the threat of these attacks on America forever.
Forever. Well, there is another issue, a serious issue here, and that is an arms control issue. And, you know, again, talking about disruption and how Trump is departing from sort of some very traditional parts of the Beltway blob thinking, and that is these kinds of systems are actually very destabilizing, and you want to think really carefully before you go down this path. Because if you go down this path and you set up a system that potentially removes any threat to you, you've now removed the promise of mutually assured destruction. So you're actually opening the door to countries to start thinking about actually first use of nuclear weapons and surviving a adversary's second strike. So it's actually chucks out a lot of the kind of fundamental bedrock assumptions of nuclear policy since World War II, essentially.
Well, you're right. And put against the Golden Dome idea, so if America is in a hurry to build this impenetrable defensive system to withstand nuclear attack and long-range drones and space weapons, China at the moment is doing a massive build-out of nuclear missiles and silos quite successfully. They'll be up to about 1,000 more heads.
Talk about silos in a bit, but keep going.
So China is doing that, looking at America's current nuclear capability and defensive systems. If it's now got this much harder problem, I don't think the PLA will slow down. I think they will double and triple down. So the net effect is going to be more nuclear weapons of more diverse types in our world to try and circumvent and overwhelm this Golden Dome system, even though no doubt a bunch of PLA analysts are saying it's impossible, but it's probably going to do something. So it is already, I think, going to speed up that nuclear arms race.
I mean, if there is the prospect that your own nuclear deterrent is now ineffective, that's going to make you do different things and act differently, whether that's getting more nuclear weapons or acquiring other weapons of mass destruction to replace the nuclear deterrent. You know, who knows? And that's the destabilizing aspect that both the Soviet Union and America, while the Soviet Union still existed, really kind of steered away from that kind of approach. So again, it's another example of Trump the disruptor, but opening the door to who knows what could come.
Well, I think a bunch of American strategists were kind of happy when Ronald Reagan gave up on his Star Wars idea for that very reason. It was a deeply destabilizing thing to do, but it was also going to be a giant absorber of American money. So this is another contradiction in the Trump program to be spending $175 billion on this new defensive system is on top of the potentially $1 trillion Pentagon budget, but it's also on top of the recapitalization of America's existing nuclear triad, you know, with the Columbia ballistic missile submarine, which is troubled and over budget and over schedule, and 21, which is, I think, broadly on schedule and cost. But
also, $1 billion a pop, roughly.
Yeah, $1 billion a pop. There's also the ground-launched Minuteman III replacement program, the Sentinel program.
So silos. We said we'd talk about silos. So, yes, the Sentinel program. Tell us about the Sentinel program, Michael, because I think it is a useful analogy to sort of ground truth the claims being made about Golden Dome.
Well, it's a continent-wide system. There's about 400 missile silos with Minuteman III nuclear-tipped ballistic missiles in them. built during the Cold War at enormous expense. The silos are away from major population centers in states like Colorado and Nebraska and Wyoming. Massive national program at the time. The Air Force said, look, you know, those Minutemen missiles, they're getting a bit old and we're not going to just refurbish them. We'll give Northrop Grumman a big contract to build replacement missiles. But the good news is this program will be easier, faster, and cheaper because we can reuse the existing silos.
We can just reuse the existing ones. What's not to like about that, Michael?
Well, and here we are.
Tell me what actually happened.
Well, here we are years later, and it turns out that initial investigation of multiple old missile silos scattered across America shows that the silos can't be reused.
That's shocking. And in fact, we have a quote here from Air Force General Thomas Bussière, who himself is shocked. He said, part of the requirements initially, 10 years ago when this program was started, was to reuse the holes, the missile holes at the launch facilities. Shockingly enough, if we look at it, that may not be the answer. Well, I have to say, he may be the only person who's shocked to learn that this approach is not going to work. And in fact, the costs have now blown out by 81% and have grown to $141 billion.
50, 60, and 70-year-old holes in the ground with silos to hold nuclear weapons might not be able to be reused. Who could possibly have expected that? But if you think about that as a cost pressure, so this is about this program, the Sentinel Renewal Program. I think the estimated cost of it now is about $141 billion US dollars. So you combine that with $175 billion of new money for this Golden Dome thing, you're coming up to, what's that, $15 billion of nuclear and nuclear protective related investment. And then there's the Columbia program and the B-21 on top of that. The sucking sound of the nuclear enterprise of America and the defensive system is enormous.
Yes, I will just pull you up on the $175 billion number. That is Donald Trump's number. Okay. The Congressional Budget Office number for just the space based elements of this Golden Dome system is $542 billion. So just one component is approximately three times Donald Trump's number. Now, having looked at US programs for a very long time, who would I believe?
Reuse some of the American existing satellites? I'm sure you can just reuse some of those satellites.
So based on prior form here, I'm going to go with the Congressional Budget Office here.
Definitely. And I also think, you know, back to one of my favorite books about defense procurement, Augustine's Laws, you know, this would be think of a number and quadruple it and you've got a working estimate.
Yes, but also think of a number and come up with a very small fraction of it. And that's the actual number of platforms you're going to get. Every single major US program recently has delivered far fewer, whatever, ships, planes.
It does make me think. Is the Australian Defence Organisation's plan on things like building guided weapons and on things like large optionally crewed surface vessels to accompany the new general purpose frigate of being a fast follower of American military procurement, is that smart?
You mean where we'll be a fast follower of an extremely slow organisation?
Yes, that's right. A slow, confused organisation.
Look, I will put one good thing about the US in here and a bit of a mea culpa. So in our last episode, we sort of bagged out the US Secretary of the Army, one Daniel Driscoll, kind of a MAGA guy, but sort of the young, handsome,
he's smart,
Ivy League trained MAGA
would
guy.
Would you say smart MAGA?
Yeah, you know, that kind of MAGA guy. So we sort of bagged him out a bit. You know, he'd written this letter to the leadership of the army and we sort of...
Well, he had one pager saying, you know, cut the hierarchy by 20%. I'm not going to tell you how to do it, just make me happy. Yeah.
So we bagged him out a bit, but one of our alert readers sent us a podcast on the site War on the Rocks, which was an interview with Dan Driscoll and the Chief of Staff of the Army, General Randy George. And I had a listen to that. And I do have to say that, you know, Dan Driscoll was saying all the right things, i.e. he agreed with us. The kinds of things that we've been saying, he was saying that we need fast acquisition cycles, we need lots of drones, lots of autonomous systems, we need to kill programs that aren't delivering, like the alleged book, the light book
story, isn't it? Because wasn't the book was for the Marine Corps? And so,
no, it's for the Army.
Oh, for the Army. But its primary requirement was
air transportability. Air
transportable in a C-130, I think.
Yeah.
And maybe air drop.
And it can't do any of that. So anyway, Dan Driscoll is killing the Booker tank along with some other programs. And one of the things he is pushing in his podcast is the use of dual-use commercial technologies, you know, taking them up from
He talked about
the border economy.
General Motors ute and putting military systems on it rather than having a bespoke military-designed ute. And I think you look at the crazy success in manufacturing output of China for commercial and military systems, part of their recipe for success is the commercial production line can do military production as well. That's their shipbuilding, that's their electronics, that's their vehicles. So
you're not saying the US should copy China, are you, Mark?
Well, the Americans used commercial production lines for most of their mass production in World War II. So I am saying that.
So I have to say that because he agreed with us, there's a lot to like in what Daniel Driscoll was saying. But the other really striking thing I got from this podcast, Mr. Driscoll is a former Army officer, junior officer. I think he left the service as a captain, but he deployed to the Middle East. He actually seems to have engaged with real soldiers. You know, he actually seems to have gone out and spoken to them and, you know, got their
what
views.
What do they need? What do they think? Yeah.
And in a way that I've never heard any Australian Minister for Defence or any Australian Secretary of Defence, you know, talk about. Engagement with the actual troops is minimal
to non-existent. Well, what I liked about it is he's actually doing something with that knowledge. So he talks about getting these companies, these fast-moving companies, and getting these dual-use product producers to work with the soldiers and meet their needs and have a very, very fast loop between the two, the manufacturer and the soldier. So he's not just doing meet and greets with the soldiers. He's doing it because he thinks it's important for how the Pentagon works. So there is a lot to like.
Yeah, so, you know, we tend to be critical of the Pentagon, critical of the Trump administration, but, you know, there was some goodness here in that podcast. We can put a link up on the website.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, the proof of the pudding is in the tasting, so we'll see what actually comes out of this in a year or two, or whether we're still in the same situation we've been in for the last, you know, 30, 40 years.
We've got time for one other thing, and we skipped this about the Middle East. We skipped the incredible victory that the US has had over the Houthis. So, you know, that failed Joe Biden, and I think everyone wishes him well with his health trouble. But, you know, he spent a year doing kind of periodic attacks on the Houthis to destroy anti-ship weapons and drones and supply facilities and weapon production facilities. And the American Navy had said, I think we've mentioned this before, that it was fighting its biggest battle since World War II against the Houthis. So that was a year under Biden. And at the end of it, the Houthis were still doing what they were doing at the start, stopping international shipping, occasionally having a successful attack on a commercial vessel. Trump comes in and he says, look, this is ridiculous. I'm going to solve the Houthi problem. Fire and fury is going to rain down on the Yemenis. Things that you wouldn't believe. Nothing like this has ever been seen before. And he gets the Pentagon to rain down death and destruction at great scale and volume on the Houthis.
And has it worked?
For 30 days. And at the end of it, the Houthis are still able to do what they were able to do the day before.
But Donald Trump declared victory.
Yes, but it turns out that victory was also claimed by the Houthis. And just looked at objectively, I think the Houthis claim holds a lot more water than the US claim, because we now have a little bit of data about the incredible expense and amount of ordnance and expensive precision systems that the Americans expended in that 30 days of fire and fury. So about $1 billion of expenditure for that 30 days of failed attacks on the Houthis.
And of ship, plane falling off a ship.
Three Super Hornets gone. One of them fell off. The other one, the arrestor wire didn't work. There was a friendly fire incident. But also they lost, I think, 7 MQ-9 Reaper drones, about $30 million each. They also used a lot of their precision missiles to intercept Houthi drones and missiles and also to attack them.
And that seems to be why Trump has kind of unilaterally declared victory and moved on, because the advice from the Chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is, we're actually running our missile stocks down to a point where if something happens in the Indo-Pacific against the really big potential adversary, China, our stocks are at dangerously low levels. So in a sense, it's, you know, to blow our own trumpet again, it's sort of proved the case that we've been making already, that the exquisite missiles, both offensive and defensive, that Western militaries are dependent on, you cannot produce them at sufficient scale, not even to defeat the Houthis, let alone China.
Well, exactly. And think about what that means for a warfighting and deterrence strategy of America looking at China. If 30 days of that level of attack again and defense against the Houthis depleted American inventories so much that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff had to call a halt to the operation. Well, what's the viable usage and production rate in a conflict with China? And so that then immediately raises that implication for Australia. If the American production system cannot even scale to meet the needs to have a continued Houthi campaign, how on earth is us depending on American supply at all to shred of an idea, let alone a foundational concept for how we're spending our money?
The other takeaway, another depressing takeaway, is that Donald Trump, in declaring victory, said, well, we've negotiated with the Houthis and they're not going to attack American ships anymore. Okay, well, what about the rest of the world? Well, unfortunately, the rest of the world is pretty much impotent. I mean, the Europeans have by themselves, without the US, virtually no capability to essentially dissuade the Houthis from blocking the Red Sea.
It's even clear that European naval deployments would be able to successfully defend themselves in the 30s.
Well, it was a case of the German deployment that went to the Indo-Pacific, and on the way home, it basically said it's too dangerous to go through the Red Sea. We're actually going to take the long way.
Yeah.
We're going to take the long way around.
Yeah. Well, and there's the other simple, nasty consideration for American allies around what Trump did to his buddy, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. Because when Trump declared victory and said the Americans would no longer attack the Houthis, I think it was the same day the Houthis fired a missile that landed in Tel Aviv's international airport, Gurion Airport. Being an American ally doesn't mean you don't get thrown under the bus.
All right. Well, gosh, that's more really depressing news to finish on. If we just very quickly come back to Australia, our listeners will recall that the Australian's Advanced Strategic Capabilities Accelerator, ASCA, was set up as an outcome of the Defence Strategic Review. It was put in
the Defence Science and Technology Group.
Yep. And a lot of commentators said that's not a really good place for it. Guess what? Defence has decided that's not a really good place for it. I'm not sure if it was Defence itself or the government, but it's been moved out of that, out of DST, put in Vice Chief of the Defence Force Group to bring it closer to the warfighters. It's now put out some of its first approaches to market in its new guise.
Yep.
So there's one on countering UAS swarms and another one for loitering munitions. So not long after that move, we're seeing some approaches to market come out.
Yeah,
so
I did notice a good thing in those approaches to market. It talks about these need to be sovereign capabilities, and it doesn't pick up that perverse definition of sovereign capability that's in the bigger defence industry development strategy.
It is a completely new definition of sovereignty.
Yeah, and it's kind of embarrassed. It's done as a little footnote. It says something like sovereign means it needs to be able to operate when international supply is disrupted.
It's a sensible definition of sovereignty. So we'll see what comes out of that. I do have to say, looking at it, though, it's this issue of when defence says it's accelerating its acquisition processes. Unfortunately, it seems to start with its existing ones and wants to kind of trim them down. I'm not sure that's the right way to go. You know, you really need to start from scratch, I think. And a good example is the US Defense Innovation Unit, which when it puts out an approach to market, it says you can actually respond with a PowerPoint, you know, a 10,
well,
15
slide you can respond
slide
with
PowerPoint.
A PowerPoint, but no more than 15 pages. Whereas I think the ASCA approach, you're right, it's the slimmed down procurement documentation. You've got to sign up to, can you assure defense that you're compliant with anti-slavery laws, for example. You know, for small companies responding to a fast-moving short-notice request, mining through even that slimmed-down paperwork takes most of their people offline for some time.
Or so, takes engineers off engineering tasks.
So it still tells me that defence doesn't get how to engage with medium and small companies.
Yeah, I think there's some goodness here. It's an improvement. It's good to see defence trying to acquire counter UAS systems quickly, trying to acquire loitering munitions quickly. So let's give them the benefit of the doubt for now.
A primary test will be, is there any investment program money for the companies that are successful? As I read those approaches to market, they're still quite clear that that is not the case.
That is the $64,000 question. So if this turns into yet another innovation exercise where an Australian company's trickle-fed some innovation money that doesn't go anywhere, unfortunately, it will not be a success. But we'll wait and see.
Yes, well, we will wait. Anyway, we're out of time, Marcus. Great to talk with you. I'm glad the Intercon bomb on China Zorilla is working well.
To say that this boat handles very nicely, and I'm really looking forward to crossing the Pacific to take it home to Uruguay.
And I wish Incat more success in a ruthlessly competitive market where they're producing premier products. Thanks, Marcus.
Thank you.